Bank of America's earnings show a housing market that's still in the tank.
But does it make economic sense to start demolishing houses?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, October 18th.
Coming up, China's economy slows. What does that mean for us?
Research in Motion has a plan to get past the damage it suffered because of recent service disruptions.
And Mayor Michael Bloomberg has a good idea for who should play him on Saturday Night Live.
I'll give you a hint. Not Marlon Brando. No, I guess that would be impossible. Ben Stelt. No.
No.
Just keep thinking about
it.
We'll tell you in just a little while ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We got earnings this morning from Bank of America, which says it made a profit of about $6 billion last quarter. But much of that came from selling off its stake in a Chinese bank and from what you might call creative accounting.
And the bank's consumer real estate division, think home mortgages, actually lost more than $1 billion. Now, Bank of America is holding a huge number of bad mortgages, probably more so than any other bank. Of course, if you look back to its time of buying
Countrywide
just a few years back. That's right. So it recently began giving away foreclosures. Closed homes to cities that demolish them. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, it costs real money to tear down a house.
Cleveland is home to hundreds of abandoned houses. Damian Borkowski manages their demolition for the city.
There's a number of costs. Firstly, you have to conduct an asbestos survey, and those run around $600.
If asbestos is found, there are more expenses. Otherwise, the cost to tear down a house is around $10,000. That includes hauling away the debris and filling any remaining hole with dirt, which isn't cheap.
Oh, yeah. We buy dirt.
Kendall Pelling is with a nonprofit community development organization that demolishes dilapidated houses in Pittsburgh. Sometimes, he says, the city recycles dirt from other properties.
If we have dirt laying around somewhere, we can get a reduced price, then we just have to pay to truck it.
Demolishing abandoned homes can prop up the housing market. In Cleveland, Damian Borkowski says it also helps the labor market.
A lot of the people now who are doing demolition were house builders, and since there's no work there, they are using their machinery to tear houses down for us.
Cleveland plans to tear down around 700 abandoned houses this year, one sector of the housing market that's still booming. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, if you want to see how the bad housing market is affecting the rest of the economy, look no further than the home improvement company Lowe's. It said yesterday that it's closing 20 underperforming stores and cutting about 2,000 jobs. Now, Lowe's is part of what's called the commercial real estate market, which includes things like apartment buildings, malls, office towers, and, of course, big box stores. For more, let's bring in Hessam Naji, who is managing director at Marcus & Millichap Real Estate Investment Services. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are a guy that watches the commercial real estate market all the time. What keeps you up at night?
The biggest risk is if we have more than a stagnation in the economy. I think we're going to dodge a recession, but if there's another shock that results in large volumes of job losses, we can see the occupancy levels start to go back down again. This is very unlikely. I think the worst of it is over, but that is the biggest risk.
But employment here in the U.S. is a bigger concern for you than, say, the debt crisis in Europe.
They're both important because we are in a global economy, and the debt crisis in Europe, if it's going through a contagion, could harm the recovery here in the U.S. But to me, the fundamentals of commercial real estate in the U.S. are the most important, and that's driven by jobs.
If you think about the sort of era of malls that we've had in the United States when they were being built big time, is that something that we're going to see going forward, or have we sort of changed our culture a little bit and we're not going to see that so much anymore?
Online sales are the fastest category of retail sales in the U.S. And because of that, the use of brick-and-mortar shopping centers and other types of retail is being reinvented and challenged. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a while before property owners find new demand for the spaces that are being emptied.
Are the office towers in cities like Nashville and Detroit, are they filling up again, or do we still have a lot of empty floors?
We still have a lot of empty floors, and even though in the last 12 months we've added close to 550,000 business service jobs, the demand for office space is going to trail the improvement in jobs because companies have a lot of excess space. It's going to take about 2 years to burn through that excess space before we see a true recovery in the office sector.
Hessam Nagy, Managing Director at Marcus & Millichap Real Estate Investment Services. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jeremy.
In Washington today, there's a key meeting going on of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC. Now, that commission is expected to vote in new restrictions at some point on trading in raw materials that are crucial to the global economy. We're talking about speculation in those raw materials and in the commodities trading. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The new rules are aimed at preventing excessive speculation for things like corn or oil. Sharp price swings can hamper economic growth and harm consumers when they flow through to the grocery store and the gas pump. The CFTC plans to limit the futures contracts a trader can hold. Backers of financial reform say that's necessary to make sure that speculators can't drive prices up or down and make a killing. But business professor Peter Wells at Cardiff University says what's really driving commodity prices higher is rising demand in the developing world.
As economies in China, India, and so forth have grown, we have started to experience, perhaps for the first time in a generation, a significant and probably enduring increase in those commodity prices.
The financial industry says the rules are too restrictive and could force market players like Morgan Stanley and Cargill to scale back their trading operations. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Research in Motion, the maker of BlackBerry, kicks off its annual developers conference today in San Francisco. Probably not the greatest time to be calling attention to yourself after all the trouble they've had in the last several days. The future of the company really is up in the air. So it is targeting an important community to hold on to its market share, app developers. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Turns out the crackberry is a habit the modern technophile can kick. It's been a rough patch for Research in Motion. There were those service interruptions for millions. Apple launched its latest iPhone, which has already become one of the fastest-selling gadgets in history. And for software developers, there just aren't a lot of reasons these days to build apps for the BlackBerry. Blame the iPhone.
91% of developers said that they were very interested in the iPhone.
Scott Schwartzhoff is vice president at AppCelerator. He says all those developers make the iPhone fun, productive, and entertaining. Thousands of apps could do almost anything you could imagine. With a BlackBerry, not so much.
The BlackBerry phone, which is clear down the list, 28% saying that they're very interested in the platform.
Schwartzhoff says RIM is in serious trouble, unless it can unveil some interesting new phones soon and get developers on board. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, now to today's Midday Extra. We're going to take a look at one company's recent bankruptcy and the legacy of rice and beans that it left behind.
Earlier this month, the owner of the restaurant chains El Torito, Chevy's Fresh Mex, and Acapulco filed for bankruptcy. And some people are saying the company changed the landscape of Mexican food in this country.
Gustavo Arellano is managing editor at OC Weekly, and he's with us right now on the phone. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola.
Hola to you. First of all, tell us about this company, and how big was it? How many restaurants are we talking about?
Real Mex was the parent company of these restaurants. The big one, the big enchilada, as it was El Torito. At its high in the 1980s, it had 248 restaurants all across the United States. When it was growing exponentially around the late 1970s, it was opening a new restaurant a week. It spread away from the American Southwest, the traditional homeland of Mexican cuisine. And for many places, it was the first time where Americans were able to have a sit-down Mexican meal.
Mm. And Gustavo, this is not just like your typical Chi-Chi's or some of these other restaurants. A lot of people are saying that El Torito actually made an impact on the kind of Mexican food that we eat.
Here's the funny thing. Chi-Chi's was El Torito's eternal rival. Out in the West Coast and in Southwest, for the most part, we don't know what Chi-Chi's is. But for the East Coast, that's their version of El Torito.
What happened was... there.
Yeah, El Torito was started in 1954 by a World War II veteran named Larry Cano, and it started in the Los Angeles suburb of Encino. In the late 1960s, he started expanding to other places in the United States. And then Chi-Chi's in the mid-1970s, it started rising up as the rival to El Torito, which is funny, though, because Chi-Chi's represented its own version of American Mexican food, Tex-Mex, while El Torito was the ambassador for what we now know as Cal-Mex cuisine.
Now, if this company... RealMex was so special, Gustavo. What happened? Why did it go bankrupt?
What happened was that Americans, they just evolved out of their taste of Mexican food. I'm doing a book on the subject called Taco USA, and one of the things that I track is how Americans' taste for Mexican food keeps evolving about every decade or so. So El Torito, during the 1970s and 1980s, it was the place for Mexican food. That's where you went to go get a margarita. Mm. That's where you went to try fajitas, which are actually a Texas innovation, not a California innovation.
Yeah.
That's where you tried the wet burrito. But now we're in an era where you could get food trucks anywhere. We're in an era of new Mexican migration that's bringing in brand new types of regional Mexican food. El Torito just, it never really evolved out of that. It just became a relic, an artifact, really, of an older time.
You know, actually, as soon as I got to California, I ordered a wet burrito for the first time.
Yeah.
So is that CalMex? That's a Cal-Mexican thing to have like a sauce on the top of your burrito?
Yeah, the way it's called in California is CalMex. In the Southwest or in New Mexico and in Colorado, there they call it a smothered burrito, but there they put chili instead of, gosh, whatever the sauce is
so
on a wet burrito.
Right,
it's a vile invention. However, the burrito originally, it came from the borderlands of Arizona and the Mexican state of Sonora, but it first became popular in California, and through California's innovations, both El Torito and also the various taco empires, that's how it spread across the United States. So the burrito very much is a part of CalMex cuisine. You also have the obsession with putting cheese on top of refried beans. You have, of course, the wet burrito. You have the Spanish rice, the combo plate, essentially. And more importantly, though, what CalMex also did was spread around the hard shell taco as well. And all of this you were able to find in El Torito. It's funny because Taco Bell and those empires, they were sort of the scouts, but El Torito and the rest of its many imitators became the pioneers in spreading Mexican food across the country.
Gustavo Arellano, managing editor over at the Orange County Weekly here in Los Angeles. Gustavo, thank you. Interesting conversation, and now we're all hungry.
I'm hungry, too. I'm going to go get some chilaquiles right now.
Oh, that sounds good.
And maybe a margarita, too.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, early, but sure.
Thanks, Gustavo.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to the Marketplace global perspective. In China, some evidence this morning of a slowing economy. The government there said that last quarter, the Chinese economy grew at an annual rate of just, get this, Steve, 9.1%. Just
9.1%. Oh, my God. That's a tortoise pace.
What a terrible growth pace.
Crawling along over there.
It's actually the slowest growth that they've had there in 2 years.
Wait. So now, what is ours here in this country? 1.3%
yeah.
versus 9.1%.
Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us now from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So 9.1% sounds pretty good to me. Why is it not good enough for China?
Well, it looks wonderful, but it's way below what they need to grow because they have to keep on keep employment growing, or they really risk a lot of civil unrest. So 9.1% is great, but they need closer to 12-13%, almost as a minimum. This is slowing due to the debt crisis in Europe and the United States. Europe is their number one customer with about $400 billion in trade. Europe and their debt crisis can't afford all this. And, of course, we've seen even our demand from China really dropping as well. So it's a trajectory that could really cause huge problems.
Well, what does it mean for us, Julie? Is it problems for the United States?
Well, China really does matter to the United States because we do export to them. You know, we've got China has machinery tools, heavy equipment, planes. All of this goes to China, and that's what brought us technically out of our recession in 2009. If they stop buying our manufactured goods, we too risk sliding back into recession here.
Well, let's talk quickly about the other big international story this morning. We've, of course, got this big deal. They're trying to reach a big plan to deal with the European debt crisis. And today we hear that Moody's may downgrade the credit rating of France.
Well, Moody's is putting everybody in a rock and a hard place. All of the European Union countries are going to be coughing up a lot of money and putting themselves at risk just to bail out Greece and to stabilize the EU currency. So France is obviously is going to be spending even more money, putting their government even further in debt, causing the possible downgrade here. So that's not going to happen just to France alone. Moody's will be looking at all the other countries and how much they have to pony up too. It really is a situation where you are between a rock and a hard place. What's going to result from it, though, is everybody's going to blow off Moody's because you're going to do what you need to do to get this job done.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always and congratulations to the St. Louis Cardinals.
The cardiac Cardinals, we did it.
Well, for more on the Moody's warning in France, let's bring in the BBC's Hugh Schofield, who's in Paris for us this morning. Hi, Hugh.
Hello.
What has been the official reaction in France?
Well, they're worried, and they've admitted that this is something they've got to keep their eyes on. And François Baroin, who's the finance minister, has effectively said that the government will take steps to make sure that it does preserve its triple A rating. And that, we're interpreting, will mean that they may well have to have more austerity, a new addition to the budget in the weeks or months ahead, if this threat begins to become more real.
What is so important, Hugh, about what Moody's had to say about France today?
Well, it wasn't a downgrading of the credit rating, but it was a warning. And, you know, as such, it's already set the alarm bells ringing. It said that there was a stable outlook at the moment, but this stable outlook might change, and that therefore the agency is going to keep France under review for the next 3 months. So it really is a kind of warning to France to make sure that in the next 3 months nothing happens to make the agency change its credit rating and mark it down. And so, you know, it is something which the government here takes very seriously, because, you know, if the credit rating changes, so of course does the cost of its debt.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Hugh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much to you.
Well, now to some drama at one of the final matches at the World Scrabble Championship in Poland, Steve. The letter G went missing during one of the games. And one of the players, Steve, asked the authorities to take his opponent to the bathroom to strip search him for it. He thought maybe he pocketed the G.
Scrabble's pretty rough.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they did not end up carrying out the strip search, but the accused did win by 1 point. You never know what was going on there. Yeah. We've had no word from the accuser.
Oh, ba-dum-boom.
NBA players and owners will meet again today to try to reach a deal on how to divvy up revenue in their new labor contract. The NBA is already canceling the first 2 weeks of the season because of the ongoing lockout. But now, as Sally Herships reports, the league may cancel games all the way through Christmas.
Fun sports fact of the day. BRI stands for basketball-related income. Yearly BRI is about $4 billion. That's how much the NBA generates in revenues when it's playing.
The owners claim that they've been losing around $300 million a year in the aggregate, putting all 30 teams together.
Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College. He says players don't believe the owners' numbers. The first 2 weeks of the season have already been canceled. But Christmas time is key because
football is about to fade out, and basketball is about to take over as the major professional sport.
If you're a team owner or a player, tis the season to sell jerseys and fill luxury boxes. So does everyone lose if games aren't played?
The teams that generate profits will suffer. The reputation and the brand of the NBA will suffer.
And businesses connected to basketball will suffer. But Zimbalist says local economies overall won't. Consumers will spend their entertainment dollars elsewhere. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, they may not be playing basketball, Jeremy, in December, but you know who's got a new album coming out?
Who?
Justin Bieber.
Oh, the Biebs.
You have Bieber fever, don't you?
I do not have Bieber fever, but I think
do.
You have
Bieber fever. I have no Bieber fever, I can tell you right now. I am way too old for that.
So he's already announcing plans for his Christmas
album. October 18th? Yeah, go figure. You know, his full Christmas album, Under the Mistletoe, is going to be out in just a couple of weeks. His Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports holiday albums like the Bieber album and others make nice stocking stuffers for the music industry.
Justin Bieber wants to cozy up this holiday season. And who can blame him?
Everybody's still demanding holiday records.
David Bakula is a VP of analytics at the Nielsen Company.
You know, if you look at last year's top sellers, the number five record of the year for the entire year last year was Susan Boyle's holiday record. You know, and you're talking about a record here that came out the first week of November.
The thing with holiday music is that we still buy whole albums. We buy CDs even. Aram Sinreich is a media professor at Rutgers University.
Holiday music looks more like the music industry did back in the 1990s.
Why? Well, because a lot of these albums are sold as presents.
People prefer to get gifts that are actually material. Nobody wants to open a box and see nothing inside it and someone say, oh, well, what I got you is just a bunch of ones and zeros. Don't worry, it'll show up on your computer tomorrow.
Big sales of whole albums aren't the only reasons artists rush to belt out Jingle Bells and Oh Holy Night. Sean Ross is the VP of Music and Programming for Edison Research. He says a couple of decades ago, studios had an epiphany.
Holiday albums were a good way to sell records by artists who weren't top of mind anymore in pop culture and who didn't necessarily get a lot of radio airplay.
Think Neil Diamond, Wilson Phillips, Amy Grant, even Mariah Carey, whose modern standard, All I Want for Christmas Is You, is likely no more than a month away from your radio dial. Okay, less than a month. A lot less. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Going to be in my head all
probably
day
everybody else.
Long.
You know, yesterday
Mariah.
What I played that Beatles song, Nowhere Man, and yeah. I got all these tweets from everybody that said,
thanks for getting that
stuck in my head all
yeah,
day
really.
Long.
Well,
by the way,
while we're
at it, Steve and I are both on Twitter. I'm at Jeremy Hobson.
there's always an opportunity
always an
to
opportunity
plug that
to
Twitter
throw that
address.
In. Steve?
I'm at
Radio Chio.
Absolutely.
All right.
Finally, Jeremy, Saturday Night Live, you may have watched this over the weekend, spoofed New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg about the protests, all those protesters who are in New York City.
Occupy Wall Street, I'm on your side. Come to New York and let your voice be heard. You'll be treated with dignity and respect by the city and the police. With one caveat, the second, and I mean the second I see a demonstrator lighting up a cigarette, we're moving in.
That is so Mike Bloomberg right there. He was played by cast member Fred Armisen. But the mayor says next time SNL does a skit involving him, he wants to play the role.
Oh, it's him.
Yes.
He's the one.
He wants to play the role.
Bloomberg.
That's right.
Yeah.
Bloomberg tells the New York Post, Jeremy, he has a Screen Actors Guild card and everything. I don't know why he has a SAG card.
You know why he does?
Why?
Because he's actually been in a number of shows. I just saw him on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh, is that what it is?
Hysterical.
Yeah,
yes.
Of course. So he has a SAG card.
Yeah.
And that he would love to negotiate with Lorne Michaels, of course, over how much he would get paid for that performance.
He really needs a lot of money,
yes,
that guy.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
My gosh. So anyway.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being with us. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.